I'm Dr. Brent Schillinger, along with my colleague, Dr. Abby Strauss. The question today, does it pay to pay someone not to take an illicit drug? There's actually a whole category of therapeutics called contingency management, which gets into this arena. Joining us to dive into the question here is Dr. Richard Rawson, PhD. Rick is a research psychologist at the University of Vermont and professor emeritus at the UCLA School of Medicine. Rick is the guy that states actually reach out to when they want to implement these CM, as they call the contingency management programs. Rick, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Brent. I really appreciate being able to talk with you about this.
CM, contingency management, this has been around for a while, 30 plus years. There's been a lot of research conducted over the years. Why is there the sudden spark in interest?
Contingency management, the first studies were done in the early 90s when we started struggling with cocaine and then methamphetamine use, and we didn't have any medications, and we still don't. And this was a technique that showed promise. There were a series of funded studies by the NIH, all of which showed that contingency management is an effective way to reduce stimulant use. The priority of addressing stimulant use sort of went off the screen from about 2005 till about 5 years ago because of addressing the opioid crisis, because of overdose deaths. That was pretty much where the focus and drug treatment area was. Starting in about 2018, 2019, and continuing, the use of stimulants has become increasingly connected to overdose deaths. The paradigm now is people addicted to stimulants go out and buy their cocaine or methamphetamine. Much of the drug supply has fentanyl in it, and getting fentanyl either knowingly or unknowingly, that puts them at very high risk to overdose from fentanyl if they're getting it as part of their stimulant purchase. Over 50% of overdose deaths now involve stimulant use. So that's brought states to be interested in directly addressing stimulant use.
Before we dive deeply into this, summarize for us briefly how CM actually works.
Contingency management is a very simple procedure. It's based on operant conditioning principles of positive reinforcement. If you reinforce a behavior, it will occur more frequently. In the case of contingency management, if the behavior you're reinforcing is getting stimulant negative urine samples from people, thereby documenting that they haven't used stimulants, you will get more of them if you give a reward. The typical paradigm is people come in twice a week, they give a urine sample. If it's negative for stimulants, they earn something. A gift card for $20 is commonly one of the paradigms. So they can earn $20 if they give a negative urine sample. And it's that simple.
The approach CM, now this is primarily for folks who struggle with methamphetamines and other stimulants. Can it be applied to other categories?
Yes, it can. We focused on it for stimulants because there's no other treatment. For opioids, for example, we have excellent medications with buprenorphine and methadone. We have treatments for alcohol that are effective, nicotine use disorder. The thing you have to be able to do, though, is effectively measure the drug use. For cannabis, it's a problem because cannabis hangs around in the metabolite of cannabis urine sample for days or weeks and makes the measurement complicated. With stimulants, it's very simple. Point of care test cups, they will accurately measure if somebody's used in the last 48 to 72 hours. And if it's negative, we're pretty convinced that they have not used. Probably the other two other areas where people are considering implementing it clinically is alcohol tests now that measure recent alcohol use and nicotine. The focus has been on stimulants just because there's such a need for effective treatment.
What's the takeaway point? What's the statistics that the research continues to show?
We're looking at things like retention in treatment and drug-free urine samples. I did a treatment program back in the 80s and 90s called the Matrix Model, which was a behavioral treatment, used cognitive behavioral therapy and education and family involvement. It was a lot of talk therapy. We published on it and thought it was very, very effective. We would get people into treatment, and we could maintain about 40% of them for a period of 12 weeks, and at the time looked pretty good. Well, with contingency management, we're able to obtain about 60% for 24 weeks. So the retention is much better with contingency management. We're able to keep people coming in. And while they're coming in, about 90% of their urine samples are negative for stimulants. So we're getting these very substantial periods of people participating in treatment and not using while they're in treatment. We don't have anything really that's in second place at this point in terms of efficacy for reducing stimulant use.
This is fascinating. And I would like to go back for a moment to when you talked about they'll get the $20 gift card if they're clean. It makes me wonder about the definitions that we're dealing with. Standard rule of thumb definition of an addict is someone who uses drugs despite the negative consequences. Here you find that somebody knows they're going to get a gift card, they can avoid using the drugs. The psychodynamics here are completely different because they can choose. So the contingency notion applies to their own decision-making process as to choose or not to choose to use a drug. I'm delighted by the idea, and I think it's wonderful if someone can control themselves. But are these people the ones who need treatment? Are they different than the, I'm going to use the more classic, maybe ill-defined term, but the more out-of-control addict?
Great question. And we're looking at data right now, a project in California. My experience, people who are coming in were the same people who are coming in for treatment that in the treatment programs, these were people who were, they were significantly impaired by their stimulant use. They'd spent all their money. They'd ruined all their relationships. They were, some of them were unhoused. They were severely addicted. With talk therapy that we were doing, we generally couldn't get anybody to stay in treatment. They just would come in and immediately drop out. With contingency management, they come in and suggest to them that if they can go 48 hours and give you a negative sample, they can get a $20 gift card. That immediacy and tangible nature of what the reward is gets their attention. Certainly, there are people who are so impaired, people who are injecting cocaine and methamphetamine, taking the drug six times a day, who are so severely addicted that they need to be treated more intensive level. These were not modest users that we're treating. These are folks that have ruined their whole lives with their stimulant use, and yet they're able to stop for 48 hours to give you a urine test because they get this tangible reward. I've spent my career, 50 years of doing work with addiction. We talk about it as a brain disease and a biological disorder, and the person's brain has changed. We've biologized our understanding of addiction to where one might get the assumption that these folks have no ability to control their behavior. Apparently, that's not the case. If there's an immediate reward that is significant to them, you can get your change, even people who are severely addicted.
In the research that you did originally, you had compared CM alone, counseling, cognitive behavioral therapy, then mixtures of that. What were you able to extrapolate?
In the protocol we were using, people were going to give a total of 48 urine samples over 6 months. With cognitive behavioral therapy, we got an average of about 16 out of 48 that were negative for stimulants. With contingency management, we doubled that. It was about 30 out of 48, which is a big difference. And when we added the two together and gave it both cognitive behavioral therapy and contingency management, we got the same number as we didn't get an incremental effect. That was my hypothesis, was if you do this one, you'll get some reduction. If you do this one, you'll get some reduction. And if you do them both together, you'll get a much bigger reduction. Contingency management was what gave us the reduction with or without the accompanying therapy.
So this pretty much proved that this is a very powerful tool, even on a standalone basis.
And my studies were two of literally hundreds of studies that have been done on contingency management for stimulant use. There have been numerous meta-analyses looking at all the studies done, all say the same thing, that contingency management is the effective treatment for stimulant use disorder. Last year, the American Society of Addiction Medicine and the American Academy of Addiction Psychiatry released guidelines for the treatment of stimulant use disorder, one major finding was that contingency management is the most robust treatment we have for treating people with stimulant use disorder.
That's excellent. It makes me want to, again, further play with some of the words, because contingency means that a person is able to decide on a behavior for reward. Might it mean that it feels good to be acknowledged that they did something good, and that's why they could overcome the drug and the need for the drug? And Alcoholics Anonymous, even NA in many ways, is along these same lines. You're not alone. We're going to applaud you, not give you a $20 card, but we're going to applaud you. You're going to be with people who are going to say, oh, that's bad. Oh, that's good. It brings people into the ability to better use their own ego resources to get better. This is fabulous.
I'm glad you brought that up, because when people hear about contingency management, obviously they think about this transaction that occurs. You almost get the sense that this could be done by a vending machine. That is not true. What happens is, when you do qualitative interviews with the patients at the end of treatment or during treatment, the relationship they develop with the staff becomes equally as important. They're able to succeed. A lot of these folks have years of their use have just been total screw-ups. Everything they've done is hurt themselves or their families or their friends. They've developed this hopelessness in their ability to be competent human beings again. With these small pieces of behaviors, and you get a gift card, positive sense of that they can accomplish this, taking very small steps, the social reinforcement from the staff, or if you have them going to group and they're getting the positive reinforcement from the group that they attend, becomes very important. People who use methamphetamine heavily, in the absence of the gift cards, if they come into a clinic and people are nice to them and say positive things, I don't think it registers. I don't think they really are able to process social reinforcement or verbal reinforcement in a meaningful way, because their brains are so impacted by their stimulant use. These gift cards seem to cut through the fog. They seem to cut through, and it gives them, I mean, for many of them, they haven't been eating, so they'll take the gift card and they'll go to get something to eat, or they'll buy their children some clothes or whatever. By the way, you should know the gift cards that we use in these projects, using all electronic gift cards that people can put on their phones. If they don't have a phone, we give them a paper. They're restricted. You can't use them to buy alcohol, tobacco, lottery tickets, or something else. I don't remember what the other thing is. But we try to make sure that the rewards that are provided are used for positive things. Now, certainly they can be traded for whatever. And we do make an attempt to reinforce that can be used for positive, constructive behavior.
One of the things that strikes me is that, because we're talking about stimulants here, is the notion of withdrawal. And a lot of times it presents the term on the street as jonesing. So if someone stopped their medication, the illicit drug, for a day or two or three, whatever your time period is, they're able to do this without going through jonesing and out of control craving in order to achieve the applaud, the thank you, the acknowledgement of the gift card. To me, that is incredibly important. And it makes me look or ask about subtypes of the, I don't know what word to use now, abuse patterns, misuse patterns, addiction patterns, the words get sloppy. It's amazing that you're not talking about what, especially in the cocaine world, they talk about jonesing.
The pattern, and this has been pretty well documented, pattern with discontinuation of stimulant use, typically a set of phases where people first are extremely exhausted, and they've completely depleted their dopamine system, they're not able to sleep and eat. When they come around, generally it's a day or two before their craving gets severe. And it's often, if you can get them started into contingency management there, their withdrawal is not as physically challenging as opioid withdrawal. They're not in a situation where they can't not use. Yes, they do experience craving. what we're offering people with this intervention is very, very immediate short-term benefit. You're not asking them to be sober for the rest of their lives. You're asking them to go home and come back in 2 days and you can get this $20. That seems to be achievable. If they're so severely in withdrawal that they're not able to function, well, that person may need to start again at a higher level of care in a residential setting. The majority do seem to be able to successfully start. And it makes a difference. The amount of the reward makes a difference. We've tried with small things, a couple of dollars or a small prize. Those things can be helpful, but they don't really cut through effectively with someone with a significant stimulant use disorder. We often start people at $10 if they get periods of significant, like a week. If they can go a week without using, it'll increase to $12. And if they can go another week, it'll increase to $15. And they'll get up to $20 or $25 and it'll level off. Some protocols will start out with $15 and just keep it significant. Over a period of 12 weeks, you probably want to have the potential to provide somewhere in the neighborhood of $400 to $500 if they do it all perfectly. In the protocol I'm running in California, which now has over 9,000 patients in it, they can earn up to $600 with perfect performance for 6 months. It's not a particularly expensive intervention, to $50 a month for people, which if you look at other interventions, certainly is no more expensive than those.
Where has contingency management been adopted? In certain states, certain healthcare systems, where are we at?
This all started, as I said, around 2020. A group of us who had done research and a gentleman named Dr. Wesley Clark, who was an official in SAMHSA, we developed a group to try to increase the use of contingency management for stimulant use disorder. California was the first state. In 2023, they initiated it for their Medicaid program. The state of Washington now has implemented it. The state of Montana have implemented it. And then there are other projects, different counties and different, the state of Vermont has implemented it. The big challenge is where do they get the funding and how do they do the funding? It can be done through a Medicaid waiver, which is a big complicated procedure that states often are reluctant to do. The one that's being used now by many states is the opioid settlement funds, funds that have been provided to states through the lawsuits for pharma companies and pharmacy companies that were involved in setting the stage for the opioid epidemic. Those funds can be used for this purpose because if you effectively treat people with stimulant use disorder, you're dramatically reducing their risk of opioid overdose.
So in terms of SAMHSA and Medicaid, the waivers, which are basically tax dollars, I'm sure you've heard the argument, why are we using tax dollars to bribe people not to do drugs? How do you answer that?
I answer it in that if you go to many of the major urban areas and rural areas of the United States right now, a lot of people using stimulants, they're creating difficulties for their families, for their communities. If you sample population like Los Angeles in the city where I did most of my work for there, there's a huge homelessness problem. And the surveys typically report that somewhere between a third and a half of those individuals are using stimulants. If you want to effectively address those issues, you have to get their stimulant use stopped. This is the only way we know how to do that. You can either use something that works, i.e. contingency management, or leave their stimulant use unaddressed. They don't get better on their own. They get dead. The issue is to use contingency management. This is not a giveaway program. People have to document that they're not using in order to get the gift card. People actually have to stop using in order to reap the benefits of treatment. That's how contingency management worked. If you give a positive test that shows evidence of use, we don't punish anybody. We don't scold them, encourage them for coming in, but they don't get the gift card. It's a pragmatic argument. If you want to see stimulant use reduced in your community, this is what you need to do.
And the cost to the system, you're saying, is about $600 in a year, which
correct
is a lot less expensive than the other elements.
We did a study with individuals using methamphetamine in Los Angeles, about 400. Of that 400, about 120 had visited the emergency room in the previous year, some of them many times for methamphetamine psychosis. Each one of those emergency room visits cost thousands of dollars. $600, if you can get someone to stop their use for 6 months, seems like a pretty good investment.
Who would you say is the ideal individual for contingency management? I'll put that in the context of, as a dermatologist, I actually supervise a wound care clinic at one of the local mobile syringe exchange programs. And as you alluded to before, yes, there's opioid use and there's a lot of stimulant use. We get that in the history. These folks, a lot of them are, like you said, unhoused and are suffering from other social determinants of health. Who's the ideal individual and where does contingency management fit?
In fact, we're actually using contingency management right now in a syringe exchange in Burlington, Vermont, where we're with the patients you're describing. About 40% of the people coming in for syringes, these are people who are actively using, that's why they're coming in for syringe exchange, volunteered to participate in contingency management. And we're seeing 2/3 of the volunteers have engaged in treatment and are reducing their methamphetamine and cocaine use at the syringe exchange. I mean, there are people who are so severely addicted and psychotic, and I mean, that aren't able to function, and they obviously need a higher level of care. But beyond that, there really isn't a good profile of who is not a good candidate. We thought that this would be good for a group of patients who maybe weren't as interested in talk therapy as patients who were interested in talk therapy. And that's why we did our study. It was clear that didn't really matter. This really worked across the board. The severity issue is probably the one limiting factor. If people are, again, so severe they need a higher level of care and can't understand what the protocol, what the interaction is all about, then they're not going to be able to participate. But they don't need to have a lot of cognitive capacity. It's not like learning how to do cognitive behavior therapy and learning all the principles of avoiding triggers. And this one's pretty simple. Come in, give me a urine sample, and you get the gift card. Clear operant behavior.
Are other states looking at this seriously? Because I would love to see this much more commonly available here in Florida.
Again, the issue for the most part is where they're going to get the money. And this idea of using opioid settlement funds that Vermont has done, Lancaster County, Pennsylvania has done, and a number of states, Maine has done, that's a new discovery. I mean, I know a lot of the opioid settlement funds are used for purchasing naloxone, use it for MOUD, and a lot of very good causes. But I think the use of those funds for this really is an unaddressed population that's particularly at risk for overdose, has nothing else to operate. Getting federal funds is right now probably less likely. And these opioid settlement funds are under the control of state. Different states do it differently. In some places, it's the counties. In some places, it's the cities. We help different groups do it in different ways. But that model seems to be the one that is solving the money problem. The other problem is this issue of, well, I don't really like the idea of paying people not to use drugs. My career and what I was doing with cognitive behavioral therapy and motivational interviewing and education and family therapy and throwing the sink at them, everything we could think of, I thought that was a really valuable approach to treating people with stimulant use disorder. Then I did this study and it was like, no denying it, this works. When you work with these folks as long as I did, you really want something that can produce a tangible change in their behavior. You can see them making progress and all the stuff about their self-esteem and their sense of being able to achieve something. When you run these programs around the holidays, it's like this unbelievable discussion about, well, I'm going to buy my kids presents for the first time and this year I can get them because I'm going to use my savings and my contingency. It really becomes pretty impressive to see what they do with this and get the sense of accomplishment and success through their behavior. So it's a really positive thing. And there isn't a state in the United States that doesn't have a significant stimulant problem. And I think it could make a huge difference in reducing that problem.
What it does is it takes the whole notion of criminalizing substance abuse away. And it mandates that the people who are paying for it, directing it, voting on it, and so on, that they be, shall we say, persuaded to understand the nuances of substance abuse. It humanizes. These are real people, and they're in trouble. It's because nothing else really has worked. History is full of many good ideas that really have not produced anything solid, except for AA and NA and those type of real involvements that involve, as you said, the relationship, the cognitive behavioral components. And to go back to what Brent said a few minutes ago, the person who is cynical because we're just paying someone to stop using drugs. When people mention that, they truly speak to their lack of understanding, again, the nuances of substance abuse. I applaud you for your work. I think it's good stuff. Really good. Thank
you. I actually sit on a committee for Palm Beach County that advises the county commission where the settlement dollars should go. We specifically want the funds to go primarily to programs that are not already in existence, looking into additional approaches and specific things that will help, and tied in a lot of it to more innovative approaches and looking at social determinants, because that's all part of the picture. So if we look overall, question always of recidivism, how does that tie in with the CM program?
If you're using positive reinforcement to establish a behavior and maintain a behavior, when that positive reinforcement goes away, the behavior may not continue. So in this case, using gift cards to get negative drug tests, when you stop giving the gift cards, what happens? The data that we've gotten so far is you do see some return to drug use. About 50% of the people who have benefited maintain their effects out to 3 years, and we haven't followed them beyond that. And what you hear people talk about is, when I was able to use the gift cards, I got started on this, and I did this over a period of 6 months, and it became part of my routine. And while I was doing that, I started to develop some other things in my life. I started exercising. The New York Times article that we did, the lady that they followed, started volunteering at a food bank and going to church services. You develop these new behaviors while you're engaging in the contingency management. And when the gift cards discontinue, you hope the new behavior will now sustain the progress they've made. And it does with about half the people, and about half the people return to use. I have to say, though, that I was around when methadone came out. We were going to use it for a short term and detox people and then have them be drug free. We'll use it for 6 months. We'll use it for a year. Treatment needs to be done over a longer term for some people. And right now our treatments are 6 months generally, and we're getting good results. Do some people need it longer? Do some people need additional kinds of therapy that you add to it to help sustain those benefits? Probably. In the California and the other projects I'm involved with, we're getting really good results. We now have to figure out, how do you extend those benefits for the people who do return to drug use? Well, if we didn't use it for the first 6 months, we wouldn't have the problem. I'll take getting part of the problem addressed, and then we'll figure out how to improve it. But it's not magic. Nobody is cured from their stimulant use disorder forever necessarily with this, but many of them get tremendous benefits. Read the New York Times article. That lady is pretty typical of what we see. People use the CM to get their use stopped, and then we try to hook them into other positive behaviors to sustain it beyond that.
And the 50% that 3 year rate is very, very impressive. Question I would have on top of that, modern technology. How is that allowing CM to be more efficacious and to reduce recidivism?
There are apps that can be used. They're still pretty much in a early stage of development. Several of them use saliva testing as the metric. They will interact with a human being via the video camera with a person at the app company. They will take a saliva tester, will put saliva on it for the designated amount of time. The result will show on the saliva test, and you can actually deliver the reinforcer electronically. So someone can do the whole contingency management procedure virtually. I think that has tremendous potential for certainly many of the rural areas in California where we're doing this project. Some of the rural counties just have not been able to participate because people can't drive to the clinic twice a week. These apps may provide a real breakthrough strategy for those. We have seen it used, though, in some populations. One of these apps was used up in Seattle in a homeless population. Many people had a lot of psychiatric problems and used methamphetamine. They tried to get them to use the app and they just couldn't figure out how to use it. It's not a secret. It's not a magical cure, but I think it has great potential to be developed as part of the treatment delivery system.
And it could actually do the mouth swabs on camera.
Yes.
So you'd know that it's a completely credible, trusted transaction, so to speak.
Right.
I just find so equally comforting is that you're talking about dealing with substance abuse problems outside of big cities. That's where most of it is. For many of us who studied, I studied in New York City. Everything was New York City. It was massive. It was right there up the block. Nobody knew what to do with someone who was in the northeast corner of New Jersey. This is all very exciting. Good.
There's still a lot of work to do with figuring out who can use the app and how to use the app. And I mean, when you talk with the app company folks, they say, oh, well, everybody knows how to use apps. Well, not everybody. And the idea of using an app may not be quite as intuitive as it is for my grandson, but I think there's great potential for it. In some cases, we're using it for half of the interaction. But I also think, as we talked earlier, the interaction with the staff person when they do this is important. And you can do some of that over the video. Maybe for some of them, we'll have some of the visits over the app and some of them in person, if that's possible. I mean, there may be different models for how to use these effectively.
Dr. Richard Rawson is research psychologist at the University of Vermont and professor emeritus at the UCLA School of Medicine. Rick, thanks so much for joining us today for this very, very important conversation.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.